Okay, so the official introduction will be done by Martin. But first, I just want to say how excited I am for Sven to come. And Sven is one of those people that's super brilliant, and you talk to him, and he's just so good to talk to. The first couple of times I met him at a Cars event and talked to him, he can just connect with anybody. I mean, his skills are impressive, and I think you'll see that tonight. So, Martin.
How can you follow that one? So, good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. My name is Martin Seerhaus. I'm the director of the Nissan Research Center here in Silicon Valley. And it's my pleasure to introduce Sven. I never know if you're from Sweden or from Germany, but no, it's Sven. So I have a little bio about Sven. He's the executive director of Cars. And, you know, the funny thing is, like, normally Sven does these kind of introductions when he's at Cars and he introduces the speakers. But this time, you know, we do it the other way around. So it's at Stanford University. I think most of you probably know about Cars. And, you know, personally, I think it's, you know, Sven and the Cars faculty and the whole institute is doing an enormous service for us here in Silicon Valley, but also I think for the world about autonomous cars and bringing this to the world. So I'm glad that you are now able to, you know, to talk a little bit about your own expertise and what you think about this. But he focuses on managing the relationships and with industry partners and academia, and I think that's what really what Cars is about, is to bring these two worlds together, and they're doing a wonderful job. And I didn't know this, but so you're actually coming from the car industry. Yeah. He comes from BMW, not in autonomous vehicles, because they don't have one yet. I'm just kidding. powertrains is what your background is, and from Munich to Palo Alto, and then to Detroit, and then back. See, people don't stay in Detroit long once they've been here. Sven has a doctorate degree in mechanical engineering in vehicle dynamics, so he actually knows what he's talking about, from the Technical University in Braunschweig. So without further ado, Sven, it's up to you now.
So the mic should be on. And Martin and Greg, I have to say, you're almost making me cry. So I've never been introduced like this. And such a great turnout in addition is certainly something that makes it a great evening. And I hope that I can tell you something new. So in walking in and connecting with some of you mentioned, oh, the subtitle sounds really interesting. So what's all about it? And I'm hoping that we can also have a good discussion, actually, that it's not just like I tell you something, you might say in the end, don't really know. So I'm hoping that I can also learn from you. And what to expect is this. Well, on the one hand, that's a summary that was drawn for my talk actually 2 weeks ago in Berlin when I had the honor to give a keynote in the capital of my home country. Yes, I did use the same title, but therefore I can recycle this thing. That's nice. But I will say I developed actually a few brand new slides since this talk back then. And so I tried to keep it fresh, tried to keep it crisp. Also, actually, what I actually do, those who know me a little bit better, and Martin mentioned it in the introduction, I manage a lot the relationships with the automotive industry. And therefore I talk to many people, and I really try to keep my things current. And therefore, even in the last 2 weeks, there were additional thoughts that I thought, oh, I actually should put this into my presentation and hopefully tell you something new about automated driving sooner than you think and different than you might expect. And what this is about is a little bit about the timeline, but mostly really what I want to talk is about different kinds of automated vehicles. So I want to take you away a little bit from this thinking, ooh, this is all about high-end premium vehicles that will have the greatest technology and you can zoom along, whether it's 65 miles an hour or 180 kilometers an hour, and the car does everything for you. I want to expand the consideration actually a little bit and actually make a statement. You know what? Automated vehicles are already happening, but maybe somewhat different than what, again, we expect or what we might have thought. But we can learn from this, and maybe we can especially learn quite some lessons from this in fields where we do have so many questions, when we always talk about, well, how do we do this on the highway, how do we do this on a neighborhood street, and how do we get this vehicle safely into just a parking spot in a parking structure. All right, so that's the introduction for the talk, maybe. I did have one slide for my own introduction as well, but this will certainly not top what Martin and Greg already said. So that's the continent I'm from. That is the country I'm from, certainly a great country for automotive engineering. I'm not going to argue with the French in the room who actually invented the automobile. The Germans think that we invented it. Italians also think they did it, and the French think they did it. Certainly the United States invented the mass production for the automobile. And I actually grew up in the north and went to engineering school, as Martin pointed out, in Braunschweig, somewhere in between Hanover and Berlin, where I got my degree in mechanical engineering. Started then with BMW, and now the next thing that's not to scale. United States is much bigger than my home country. Oh, we got both mics. We don't need both mics. So this works. Okay, good. And then almost to the day 11 years ago, I got transferred to the BMW Silicon Valley office, which now is in Mountain View. Back then, it used to be in Palo Alto. And after 3 years, BMW said, well, time's up, have to go back. And I said, well, maybe there's something in between. And there was actually hybrid powertrain development in Troy, Michigan, working together with GM, Daimler Chrysler, and I was on the BMW side of a collaboration. And then a little bit over 5 years ago, I then left BMW and started with Stanford, back then with professors Cliff Ness, Sebastian Thrun, and Chris Gerdes, who's still the head of the Center for Automotive Research. We started back then, which is now, what Martin pointed out, really an exciting thing to bring together automotive industry and academia. Well, the topic that we arguably discuss the most within our Center for Automotive Research is automated vehicles, and I will use the term automation. If you want to say autonomous, that's your thing. If you want to say driverless, that's your thing. If you want to say self-driving, that's your thing. I call them automated because that seems to be the term that's being used in the technical and the scientific world. We can discuss in length later on if that's the best term or not. And I'm sure when Steve Schlatter was here, he told you what autonomous might actually mean. So I'm going to talk about automated vehicles. And the introduction to this topic, relatively straightforward. Well, the computer takes over, at least in part, the driving task from the human. And in the hope that we can improve safety, maybe also some emissions, maybe some resources problem, and maybe also some congestion. And while I will not talk about all these topics in length, I will talk about safety a little bit. These three question marks, I definitely want to point out, that is something not to be taken lightly. I'm not sure if there was already someone talking about the overall implications of automated vehicles to the traffic in general, what that might mean. And maybe that was discussed in this meetup already in the past. Because it is really something, if driving is not a hassle anymore, we might drive even much more. And therefore, actually, quite some research is happening in this field as well, what it actually means if vehicles can drive themselves, if it doesn't really matter if you're stuck for 45 minutes in traffic because you can do other work, and therefore you might actually choose to move even further out. So some people quite suggest that automated vehicles can lead to even more urban sprawl or new urban sprawl, and we shall see how that works out. Anyway, but the motivation for automated vehicles or automated driving, I typically try to summarize them in four topics. Safety, which is basically, and I assume those numbers were discussed here, that we have 34,000 people killed in traffic accidents in the United States alone every year, 1.2 million people killed in traffic accidents worldwide every year. And the statistics go that about 95% of those accidents can be attributed at least in part to human error. Doesn't mean that human error causes all of these accidents. It's really important to consider. But really, people are not as good as we always think in controlling an automobile. And therefore, we hope that we can make vehicles safer if we automate even part of the driving task. And then efficiency, that's another thing where there's actually quite some research and interesting experiments going on. how good we are at controlling automobiles. And there are some of these things where you actually see, well, we are not that good at creating a constant traffic flow at a certain speed if there are too many vehicles coming together. And the hope really is that if you automate much of this, you can create a smoother traffic flow. You can maybe even space vehicles closer together and therefore take advantage of aerodynamic drag and so on. Extended mobility, that's actually a pretty important topic. So if your skills maybe get a little bit degraded over time and therefore you're not that good at driving anymore, well, maybe the vehicle can help you. And I'm not suggesting to put just a dog into the car, but maybe people who are not really up to the task with the full skills of driving, where you can also help the younger part of this population with vehicle automation. So what we call extended mobility, basically people who are somewhat limited in their mobility can get help from an automated vehicle. And I personally think convenience is maybe something that is, after all, the biggest driver for automation. Yes, we do talk a lot about safety, and safety is really important, but also I think we have to acknowledge we are talking a lot about, well, what else can we do if we don't have to drive anymore? And then we talk a lot about at least texting while driving, maybe even more things. So I would really say these four topics, safety, efficiency, extended mobility, and convenience, certainly make up the bulk of the reasoning why we want to go into automated vehicles. Now, I'm sure at least some of those videos have been shown here in the past. And so this is maybe what you expected when you come to a meetup here for the autonomous driving enthusiasts. And this is not that much what I will talk about, because I understand that many of the experts actually were already here. I know that Chris Gerdes, for instance, was here. I know that Anthony Lewandowski was here. And they told you a lot about what they are working on, where they really make those vehicles happen. They did tell you about that GPS would be very handy, actually, to automate a vehicle, that laser camera and radar computer vision helps a lot to detect actually what's in the way of the vehicle. Wheel speed sensors, inertial motion sensing unit, and then central processing unit that you finally can automate steering, brakes, and throttle of the automobile. So that's the basic concept, which I will also discuss in the other applications, the other automated vehicles that are being automated. And if you wanted to go a little bit deeper, I just want to show this in order to frame the subject maybe a little bit. So we typically talk about the user needs to enter a destination where the user or the driver or the human or the commuter, however you want to call that person that is now being driven, enters where he or she wants to go. And then you get all this information, what we just saw from GPS units and so on. And then you certainly need an electronic map that you know which roads you can actually go on. And then you do your routing. Then you do your maneuvering, which is really more like how do you make a turn? Do you maybe cut a corner? How do you actually get from one lane to another? And then you do some path planning where you splice all this together. And then you can determine what goes to the steering, what goes to the acceleration, and what goes to the deceleration, the brakes. So that's basically how an automated vehicle works. One very important piece, don't take the picture just yet. One more animation is coming. Those of you who are taking pictures, there's more information maybe necessary, which is how do you communicate with environment. And the most important piece actually might be using laser, radar, and cameras to actually avoid all these obstacles. So that, I assume, one way or another has been discussed quite a bit. And however deeply you might be working on this topic or might be just interested as an enthusiast. So this is what we're talking about. The vehicle gets a lot of information, then does all this routing, maneuver planning, path planning, so that it can, in the end, over electrified steering, electrified brakes, and also electrified powertrain, execute the driving task, what the human is doing today. Now, a timeline could be relatively easy. So this is a depiction that I've been curating for quite some time now. As we were moving in the automotive field from warning and information systems to assistance systems to now partially conditional or high automation, which you can discuss later what the different levels mean, and then to full automation, just so you know, Full automation means you just press a button, the car takes you there, whereas partial, conditional, and high automation, so this piece here, this would be a lot like all the different steps in between when we get to the fully automated scenario. The timeline is somewhat foreseeable, actually. So if we say, well, we've seen over the last 30 years or so getting more and more of these warning and information systems into the vehicle that arguably maybe started with navigation systems, and kind of the latest was maybe pedestrian protection, pedestrian detection, and maybe some sort of lane departure warning systems. Then getting into the assistance piece of it, which arguably started with ABS, anti-lock braking systems, and kind of the latest is maybe the parking assist, where the system helps you to steer the vehicle into the parking spot. And now we are entering the next phase of this, and this is really what I find is very exciting times, where we are now getting into traffic jam assist, and we'll discuss a little bit later what that means, and even more automated parking where the driver needs to do even less, and then we might get into automated highway driving, maybe some valet parking, which is being discussed a lot. But the ultimate vision of the fully automated vehicle, that is still what I find hard to tell when this might happen. Well, but we know relatively well what that ultimate vision will look like. And this is a picture, and those of you who know me a little bit better, yes, I'm always showing this picture because I love it. That's from a book that my parents bought around the time when I was born. You saw earlier when I was born, it was in 69. So that book was about the future. And the future in the year 69 was the year 2000. So the idea was in the year 2000, we would have self-driving cars, and we can just play cards and have a drink and swivel around our driver's seat and enjoy a good time with friends and family. Well, that's the vision of tomorrow's driving. Reality of today's driving is this. Doesn't look too bad. But that's, in the end, what advertising obviously wants to tell you what driving is all about. The reality of driving really is this. We do many other things while driving. We get distracted by our loved ones. Maybe driving is so boring that we actually might fall asleep. Maybe our best friends become our best enemies just in mid-driving session. Or maybe the enemy is outside. Or actually, we did not download the latest navigation software. And therefore, driving is not just that easy. And that's obviously the idea, where automation can help us a lot, because again, we are not that good as humans as we would hope. Now, the question, how do we get there? If this is today's scenario, and this is tomorrow's vision, what's in between? How do we get there? Well, let's see if we can figure out something together. This is traffic jam assist, which is basically the idea if you're in a congested area, relatively low speeds, typically on a highway, where your vehicle basically follows other vehicles, stays within the lane, because it's relatively low speed, because there's typically on a highway, there are no kids at play and something like this. Probably relatively straightforward to do. And then there's a lot of talk about self-parking, so that the vehicle can find its parking spot, and we need to see what that actually means. If I still need to stand there and press a button and actually say, yes, it's okay, yes, it's okay, yes, it's okay, or if I just drop off the car at the entrance to an automated parking lot and the vehicle vanishes just by itself. But there's a lot about automated parking. And then there's Super Cruise, at least this is something, or the name that GM seems to be using, which is really more or less the opposite of the traffic jam assist, which is basically if you have a very empty highway, and then the vehicle can basically follow the lane markings and slow down a little bit for other vehicles. But would not be possible to do the same things, let's say, for kids who all of a sudden run on the street. And maybe there's something about highway platooning. That's also something that's being discussed quite a bit, and where you basically have one lead vehicle. Hope you can at least get a sense of what's on this picture there. So there's one lead vehicle in this scenario. It happens to be a truck, because that's something that Volvo Trucks, for instance, works on a lot. And then other vehicles behind it follow, basically just pearls on a string, the lead vehicle that's then being driven by a professional driver who basically maintains the speed within reason and who maybe watches out for other road hazards, but the other vehicles behind it can just follow such a road platoon. And hopefully this gets us there. Timeline, We shall see. So it looks like that 2014 is the year of the traffic jam assist, so more and more manufacturers are launching these systems. Again, that's something in a very congested area that the vehicle can follow other vehicles within, let's say, like a school of fish. Self-parking, maybe in 3 years from now, maybe another 3 years from now, we might see Super Cruise, and maybe then again another 3 years, might be highway platooning. I should probably put even more question marks behind there. I'm not really in the business of forecasting. Let's do questions later. I'm not really in the business of forecasting what is going to happen when, but it's really something where we might assume that these different, let's say, flavors of automation might come into play in this way. Well, and now here's the point. That was very linear. Maybe we should look a little bit left and right. So if we talk about all these automated passenger vehicles that go anywhere, so anywhere really mean on a highway, meaning in a residential area, in a business district, maybe in a parking lot, there's something that is only being talked about for highways. And I could imagine Steve Schladover talked here in this group that he probably talked about automated highways. Maybe that's something to reconsider. Maybe there's something where we can look into something. Well, what if part of the intelligence, part of the automation is actually on the highway and not just on the vehicle, which can maybe help to coordinate traffic even a little bit more. There might be just dedicated lanes where you say, you know what, on this lane you only get if you have a certain technology on your vehicle so that you segregate actually the traffic a little bit more, that you don't have what I assume is one of the biggest challenges, maybe the mixed traffic. So mixed traffic meaning there are currently in the United States 250 million vehicles that are controlled by humans. And if you add the few automated vehicles to this, the question is if the whole system, which I would call a somewhat organized chaos, what traffic is out there, but it works. If that actually works still, if you add like automated vehicles to this that are exactly following the rules, that maybe have a somewhat limited environmental perception, and are in the end still controlled or, let's say, at least programmed by humans. So looking into these automated highways, I think they can be pretty interesting. Now, but really two completely different automation areas I want to look at is what's happening in the urban mobility, where today we basically take our automobiles downtown trying to find parking spot. Actually, to try and find parking in downtown area, supposed to make up about 30% of downtown traffic. Maybe there's something in this area here where it's like a very basic, slow-moving mobility concept, which can be on demand, where you basically call up this vehicle with your smartphone, picks you up at your location, you enter your destination, drops you off, vanishes, done. Might be much, much easier because this vehicle then is only being used, let's say, in San Francisco downtown. No way anyone will take this thing on I-5 and wants to be tomorrow morning in Los Angeles. But this is the problem that we see with passenger vehicles. If you sell an automobile, you have no idea who's buying this car, what they're going to do with it, where they're going to use it, and even less if they're ever going to read the owner's manual. Whereas with something like this, you can make sure that whether you call this geofenced, or basically if you set up your operating realm properly, that it's only being used, let's say, in between Union Square and Moscone Center. Much easier. And we will see later how that might actually help vehicles on the highway as well. Well, the other topic that I find very interesting is mining industry and agricultural vehicle, which you see in the bottom left corner there. There's still a proud worker of this huge truck, which is in a surface mine, used to drive this vehicle 8 hours a day or something like that. Well, this vehicle over here doesn't even have a human on board at all. So there's a lot. Some of you are maybe familiar with what Komatsu is doing at the Rio Tinto aluminum mine in Australia, where they have, I think, in the order of 12 or so driverless, and therefore you can call them autonomous or automated, whatever you want to call them, vehicles that are only controlled by a centralized mission control. And these vehicles are basically moving around, roaming around in this surface pit mine to basically collect the aluminum ore and discharge it at another location, and then they circle around. also a much easier deployment case because these aluminum ore mines are basically fenced, so you can basically say, well, no one gets in here. And if someone gets in, you can actually make them sign a waiver, like, yes, I acknowledge there might be self-driving vehicles in operation here. And you can establish a communication system, which is hard to do. Those of you who are maybe familiar with this vehicle-to-vehicle communication infrastructure that's being worked on under the Department of Transportation, how tough it is to deploy something like this. But if you have an aluminum mine of maybe a few hundred acres or something like that, we can say, okay, we establish a few Wi-Fi hotspots here, and then we can actually have connected vehicles right there. Well, as linear as it looks right here, it's probably not going to be. And this is now my point, and I hope it's not going to disappoint you when I get to this thing now. Well, maybe sooner than you think, but different than one might expect. There's actually quite of this already happening here. So we do already have these fully automated trucks in the pit mine, and the Rio Tinto operation, I think, started in 2012. So they've collected already some experience with this. These automated urban mobility systems are about to be introduced, so that's a very interesting thing to follow as well, how that is going. And what I mentioned earlier, maybe there's something about platooning or some separated highway lanes in the next 10 years where we might see at least a little bit more of pilot deployment. Many of you might know actually that down in San Diego, some of these things were showcased already before the change, before the turn of the millennium. And in the end, I think we can safely say all of this will help. All of this will help to understand actually how we get from our reality today to the vision of tomorrow, which is to just be in a car, you just enter the destination, and then you just swivel around your chair or your seat and get to the destination while you have a drink or play cards or whatever you might want to do. Okay, but another aspect of this maybe, what I wanted to discuss here tonight is, well, one is if it's all that linear, but maybe are there other paths, like is it one straight shot or is it like all the intermediate steps or is it maybe also a little bit of a transfer that we see there? Or basically, in other words, what is the evolution, what is the revolution, and what is the transformation? Some of the things that you spotted already in the previous slide when I say, well, there are definitely coming influences from other fields as well. And I want to entertain those three categories a little bit more. Evolution, which basically is more and more of technology gets into the high-end vehicles. Revolution, which is really all of a sudden as a game changer. And then transformation, where we say, well, maybe we need to go a little bit sideways before we go straight forward again. Well, for those three trends, I think there are also three key players or at least three groups that are working in those fields. And let's take a look at those three groups: evolution, revolution, and transformation. Well, on the evolutionary side, I would see really where all the driver assistance is getting more and more powerful and more sophisticated. And these are the OEMs, the original equipment manufacturers. So this is the vehicle manufacturers of the world and the tier one suppliers like the Continental, Bosch, Delphi, Denso, and so on, who are providing many of the components and systems for those vehicles. I'm not going to give you any company names, but the revolution might come from IT companies who are obviously getting more and more active in this field as well, have been active maybe for the last 4 years. But really what we might think, how does all this fit together? And this is really what I'm saying as someone who's not affiliated with any company directly, despite Stanford University. It's really interesting to talk to all the different players in the field, and very often it's like them and us and something like this. So let's try maybe to integrate this a little bit, and let's see if we can pull this together, how the traditional automotive industry and IT companies that are getting into the space of self-driving vehicles or vehicle automation as well. And really for the transformation, I want to look a little bit at this urban mobility concept that I showed you on the previous slide, which is basically this people mover where you enter something into your smartphone, vehicle picks you up at your location, drops you off at your destination, which is largely startups and maybe some service companies that say, maybe we can do something as well. some pictures that go with this. So this is what we saw in the previous animation, the more linear evolution of the field. There, you probably guessed it, this would be something that I would show under IT companies getting into self-driving vehicles. And then startups, we saw already an example, one of the previous fields as well, for instance, where this vehicle here is demonstrated in Paris. Well, the motivations, if you want to look at them a little bit more, the way how I see it, and we can certainly discuss later if you agree with this or not, but the traditional automotive industry really is about to enrich its product value, largely in the field of safety and efficiency, as we saw earlier, but I find also the convenience needs to be emphasized quite a bit. So basically, they want to keep their vehicles up to the top of the standard. There's certainly an arms race going on who has more automation in the vehicle. Now, the revolution, this is, I think, some new business to the IT company, because the IT company traditionally hasn't really been an automotive manufacturer, not to that extent an automotive safety system supplier or something like this. But might also be of much interest to them to look into mobility and data services. We really like, well, why do they want to do all of this? And it might be something that they say, well, we want to be the provider of data, maybe for the ones on the very left. And maybe there's an idea of, well, look, if people can enjoy a self-driving car, they can use the internet while driving. And those startup companies, probably some sort of mobility on demand, what I called out earlier, which is, again, a service provided and maybe more for the last or first mile solution, which is basically where the public transportation network is not good enough or where it doesn't really make sense to drive your own car, where you can basically say, well, I call one of these things. I don't care how it looks. I don't really care if it's fast or not. I just care that I get there and that it's convenient. Well, what are the competencies of these three players? Let's take a look. The vehicle manufacturers and tier one suppliers have a lot of process and experience from building vehicles in general. So they know a lot about how to test those vehicles. They know a lot about how to manufacture those vehicles. They know a lot how to distribute those vehicles to take care of marketing and sales, operation, and service of these vehicles. Okay. Automobile business, automotive business, as usual. Now, the revolution, what's coming out of that direction? Well, that's the IT companies, what I mentioned earlier. Bring in also experience, maybe from a slightly different field, but also a lot of creativity. Maybe something where really the automotive industry needs a little bit to look outside the bun. And AI, which is something where the automotive industry maybe traditionally has been a little bit hesitant. How do we want to use artificial intelligence in our vehicles? And therefore, I really applaud the local offices around here from the automotive industry that really reach out and get more and more of artificial intelligence technologies into the R&D process. Unconventional design to really try something different. But also, at least the one company that I did show has a lot of experience with road testing, whether you believe it or not, but it is something, 500,000 miles, that is a lot. That's not necessarily what every car company can claim to have done with their automated vehicles. A lot of expertise in data management, online services, and also new business models. Well, how do you make money with all of this? I think there's something that can be learned from IT companies as well. Now, what about our startup companies? Certainly a lot of creativity, but also flexibility. And by flexibility, what I mean to really look completely new at maybe some vehicle concepts. The vehicle that you saw earlier is maybe not the prettiest vehicle, but maybe it serves a certain purpose. Some new business models, trial and error mentality, which is not really the strength maybe of the traditional automotive industry, pretty lean R&D process, cross-boundary innovation. What I find very interesting, no historic baggage, which really is something, well, if you are one of the prime car companies of the world and you want to come up with a self-driving car, something goes wrong. It's very different than when a startup company maybe has a problem with the technology. And this is really what I think where we need to be open and really say, well, you know what, it's not really something them and us and they don't know anything and we know everything. There's really quite something how all this can fit quite nicely together. We take testing here, and the operation of those vehicles here, and we should take maybe more as well, but I wanted to limit the choice a little bit, and also the service, how you actually make sure that the vehicle also runs well in 10 years from now, maybe 12 years, 15 years from now. But definitely the unconventional design, and I want to emphasize again, also the experience really that IT companies have collected with these self-driving cars already in practice. Then that fits very nicely together. Data management maybe should be added, and online services. So many of these things really fit together quite nicely. And from the startup companies, maybe new business models, and I really find this no historic baggage is a very important one. Now let's see, I wanted to put this in here to really also encourage a conversation and discussion, that it's not so much like, oh, they know everything, they don't nothing, they don't know, they know everything, they don't know anything. And there's really much more like, you know what, we are already at a stage where we can definitely point out who knows what and how might all this fit very nicely together so that we do get to our nice vision. And those different categories of automated vehicles can actually be sorted quite nicely into a roster, what I find. If we look at the different levels of automation or maybe a decreasing driver activity, so basically from left to right, the driver needs to do less and less, and that goes somewhat in alignment with the different levels of automation as defined by different institutions, where it's talking quite a bit, well, the lower levels of automation, the driver needs to constantly monitor what the vehicle is doing. The higher levels may be just a very rare takeover in terms of an emergency that the human needs to take over. Or the ultimate scenario, again, no interaction at all. And I find, and this is really the important piece when we talk about these other automated vehicles, that we need to talk about an increasing deployment area. Because what I showed you earlier, we do have quite some examples already, like the pit mine example, where it's an enclosed environment where you're really in control what is happening, who's getting in, or even more, who's not getting in, and maybe even have people sign a waiver and maybe bring out a communication system. Limited deployment, which I would call something like just a downtown area where you can say, okay, it's being operated in downtown area. There might be certainly kids at play or something like this, but no way that it's being operated in downtown San Francisco and therefore will show up tomorrow morning in Denver or something like this. And the unlimited would be the vehicle can be driven wherever you want. I did not talk too much about the agricultural equipment that much, but there are some things that would probably fit in this category. I would fit actually one automated BMW, back to your introduction. But I basically chose it not in order to advertise any certain vehicle or something like this. More like really the example of automated vehicles on a racetrack, which certainly is a limited environment. You don't typically get on a racetrack unless you register at the entrance and you maybe, again, actually sign a waiver or something like this. And those vehicles are typically being operated. The vehicle can do mostly everything by itself, but every once in a while, the driver should be there if there's an unforeseen situation. And for this example where we said in the surface pit mine, that really is something where there's not even anyone on the vehicle anymore, so therefore no one there to take over the operation. Going into the vertical, I would put this example here. Again, not that I want to advertise any specific vehicle, but what Mercedes, for instance, showed last August with the Bertha-Benz drive. I would put it in this category because it was a limited deployment. They basically mapped this out from Mannheim to Pforzheim in Germany. They could not do it at the very same time if you ask them, well, now do it here in Sunnyvale to Palo Alto. They would need to map that out and everything. So this is why I would call this maybe a limited deployment and constant monitoring. If you watch that video, you basically see those hands awfully close to the steering wheel at all the time, which is an indication, I find, that, well, this is great technology. It is something also to acknowledge, yes, we are still testing still many of these things. I might want to put maybe an automated parking scenario in here where the driver is still monitoring how the automated driving or the automated parking scenario proceeds, but still it's something that should work in a parking spot here in Sunnyvale, should work in a parking spot in Boston on Berlin or Kyoto, what have you. So this is how I would maybe make up the main axis of this. Now, I'm putting this vehicle here, because that is something where, to my knowledge, they are in most of the operations people in that vehicle, and therefore they are monitoring what is going on there. And typically, you might need to map out a drive before you actually then do the self-driving operation. Going a little bit further, I would put this vehicle that I showed earlier, the urban transportation vehicle here, which is, again, there's not even a human on the vehicle anymore. Therefore, there's no interaction with a human. But it's still a very limited deployment because you have to map out the area first before you use actually this vehicle. Platooning, I would put this up there because there is someone still in those vehicles that can take over. Maybe something unforeseen has happened. But basically, you can operate a platoon in many different regions. And the ultimate scenario would still put it very far out there. And this is really what I'm hoping that shapes maybe the understanding a little bit better. There are many different flavors of automated vehicles. But the ultimate vision, which is I find sometimes a little bit too soon, basically said, OK, that's what I want. That is quite a journey how to get there. So from those current research vehicles that I showed you earlier, again, quite some of these things are happening. And we could watch those videos from those examples. But I just want to have them in the background. Because if you look at this, so this is the example from London Heathrow, which obviously has still rails, so that vehicle needs to stay into a pre-confined lane or rail, if you want to call it this. Then maybe this here would be the next step. Do you see my pointer? Yes. Where the rail is basically replaced with GPS, so a virtual rail, if you will. And then you have down here those operations where you limit the area where those vehicles are being driven, especially in those examples here, you might say on what routes those self-driving or driverless trucks in the surface pit mine where they can operate. But these are really those fields where I can see that we can learn a lot from it. Even if it doesn't seem to be the same thing that maybe most of us are hoping for, that we can, on the way home tonight, just press a button, car takes us there. But we can learn from these. We can even learn from a tractor and a farming operation for something that we might use on the highway in what we saw with the evolutionary approach, what we can maybe use in the not-too-distant future. So if we look at this, well, what is it? What is all this learning about? What can we really take away as a message from this? Let's say, despite that those people movers, mining trucks, farm tractors, and even container bridges, so in container harbors, you have these self-driving vehicles that move around these huge shipping containers, and they are very slow speed typically. It's a very limited operation, and it's a very known environment, so you know where all this is happening. Still, what can we learn from this? Well, we can learn, really, how does it work with the safety? How does it work with the safety if you don't really have someone on these vehicles, or if you automate to a very high extent something where the human maybe just monitors what's going on? So we can exactly understand these things. If a human monitors those systems, do they actually monitor it, or do they just get bored and tired, and the monitoring is actually not happening that long? Maybe after 5 minutes, do they start using the cell phones? After 10 minutes, do they fall asleep? After 20 minutes, there may be no monitoring at all. And this backup with a human, how well does it work? Like, is it always a good assumption that, yeah, there's a human who can take over? By the way, same thing that we're seeing with airplane crashes. We still don't know what happened, tragically enough, about a week ago with the Malaysian Airlines aircraft. But those of you who may be a little bit more familiar with recent airplane crashes, flight from Rio de Janeiro to Paris, in June 2010, I believe it was really a very tragic example, where the backup of a human might not work that well if all of a sudden the plane says, you are in control. Arne, are you in control?
Absolutely.
Good. There was on cue, so Arne is always in control. But Bill, are you in control?
Of course.
okay, you're too good for this. But you're not normal. You're not normal. All right, but you're great. So, and the other thing, the communication with the environment. So really something where I said earlier, well, this is all mapped out, and this is basically pre-confined and predetermined, and they have a communication system available. Well, do you really need this, or can you do without? And maybe even more important than to learn about all these safety measures, I'm not sure if we know enough about how humans actually interact with those vehicles. And this is something what one of our great colleagues who passed away in November, Cliff Nass, researched obviously a lot. How do humans interact with increasingly level of automation, increasing level of technology in general? And do they feel comfortable when they're entrusting their lives to a computer? And this we discuss obviously already, if it's just like putting a computer between the foot on the throttle of the vehicle, the pump, some people say, I don't want this. No idea how you would actually then meet the emission standards or something like that. But that is really something where you can certainly say, yeah, put all this laser sensor and radar on a vehicle and so on, and then the car can drive itself. But do people feel safe in that? Do they feel comfortable? And do they accept, and I think there was the last meetup that you had with Patrick Lynn, who talked about the ethical aspects of vehicle automation. If there's hopefully much, much less harm, and that's the premise, obviously, what I showed in the beginning, why we want to go in this, there's much higher safety, but still we probably need to assume there will be accidents. And therefore, will society accept this? And this is this discussion which I assume was extended quite a bit because I know that Patrick does a great job at this. If you say, well, if humans make mistakes and bad things happen, society has come to accept this somehow. But if a computer makes a decision and bad things happen, how does that look like? And actually surrender to computers if they're just better. And there's some ego at play. There's something like, well, yeah, sure, but I can drive better than this thing. This thing is much too slow. I don't want it. So that's really something in which we can learn a lot from even these relatively simple deployments. And also about the interfaces. How the control can be regained by the driver. Don't take pictures yet. I always do 3x3. So, and can control be regained? So what do you need in order to actually take over the control for the vehicle? And then the information, which is somewhat connected to the other piece, the information that's actually necessary that you feel comfort and trust. Is it something like we are slowing down because there's a backup in half a mile in front of us and we are now going down to 40 miles an hour so we don't have to stop so abruptly in 20 seconds? It's like, I'm slowing down because of a backup in front of us. It's really the something, and it might not be the same thing. Actually, the very first slide I showed you, my summary for my Berlin talk, we had like a pretty nice discussion session there. What information do you need to exchange? And it's really something, if you are reading, you probably don't want the car talking to you all the time, what it's doing. But if you are sitting there and watching what the car is doing, you might want to know that this your car is actually seeing this car. Because this is what you might be like as a passenger in a vehicle. Hey, do you see this? Do you see this? Hey, slow down. Which is very different than me just reading in a car like, well, I don't care, I don't want to be bothered because I'm trusting this thing. There might be different settings in the information that you want to exchange with then the passengers in the vehicle. And lastly, now it's 3x3, or actually 4x3, but fine. The companionship between human and computer, which really is something, is it a master-slave? Is it on the same level, like two peers? Or is it something like a trainer or a coach? We looked at one vehicle earlier that's actually called a track trainer. We talked about the younger population maybe needing some assistance early on, elderly maybe as well. So how do you design all of this? And this is what we can learn from these examples that we saw earlier. Because there are still, to some extent, in some cases, humans in the loop, which we saw in this depiction here. But to come to a close, I really want to not really initiate, but emphasize another discussion. One piece that is really missing, I find, when we talk about automation. I find when we talk about automation, we have to talk about communication as well. Because in these examples here, those that are the most advanced, they all use communication. There's none example here that works without communication. The platooning uses communication between those different vehicles. Also a great company here in Silicon Valley working on this, how you can platoon vehicles and what communication link you need in between those vehicles. This vehicle that I showed here, not sure if you can still see it that well, but that was the urban mobility piece that is connected to a remote operator that watches what the vehicle is doing, even if not being present with the vehicle. And also these Komatsu trucks in the Rio Tinto pit mine actually have a centralized operator that could maybe push a kill switch if need be. So the question is, can we actually do automated vehicles without communication? And this is, again, something where I don't want to say them and us, and yeah, they are doing their automated vehicles and they don't really care about our communication, and the others say, you know what, they're communication people, they've been working on this for 15 years, it will never happen by the time we have our autonomous vehicle ready. There's actually quite a nice overlap, I find. So if we look at something like time to collision, so how much time will it take until we have the tragic incident? And we can measure this and put it in a logarithmic scale. Yes, I do know that 1 minute is not 100 seconds. Therefore, I did move everything a little bit further to the left, saying with 1 hour is not 100 minutes, I know. So it should be about to scale, much better than the US and Germany example, which was not to scale, but this is much better to scale. So, and then if we consider a vehicle moving at a certain speed, so what does it encounter in what time and how much might the environment change? So their moving object can move or can change its location very rapidly, quite a time span, even right before the impact, things can happen. Stationary object, if it's a stationary object, it's a stationary object. If it's in the order of 1 to 10 seconds out, then we should definitely consider it. And that is maybe an easier task. You can even put this on a map. But moving objects are obviously a pretty big challenge, or bigger than stationary objects. The trajectory, really, how you want to go through a turn, how you want to go through a curve, or which lane you want to choose, that's happening within a few seconds, maybe. And then there's the traffic in general, which is something that might take even longer, which is like, you know what, next weekend there will be a lot of traffic because it's supposed to be 80s and everyone's going to go to Santa Cruz. So this is much more longer time, but traffic within 10 seconds probably is not going to change much more. And then there's weather that's maybe changing even slower. Now, we can do a lot here with sensors. Sensors even to the impact. Obviously, we use sensors to fire an airbag. That is the fastest, I guess, that we have for the safety-related things. But with sensors, things that are more than 10 seconds out, I don't really want to draw a line dramatically. Therefore, I put a little bit of a slope on there. But this is basically how far you might get with sensors. With sensor, you don't really get information that's 1 hour out. But maybe with Wi-Fi communication. So this is, those of you who are really into those things, this is where dedicated short-range communication or what's happening under the U.S. Department of Transportation initiative, what they are a lot working on, really a very, well, let's say like a specialized, or it's called dedicated, obviously, communication network just for vehicle safety. Probably you can do many things, but I guess you can also do many things with a cellular network. Maybe not as reliably, maybe not the same short latency, but within a few seconds, you probably get some information to a moving vehicle. And now if we take all of this together, if we say, well, this is the field of automation, then it actually might make sense to look, what are everyone's challenges? And shouldn't we maybe connect all of these? Let's say for automation, there's a lot of work currently happening in academia and in industry. The applications are relatively clear. We're always talking about the automated vehicle on the highway. We are talking about the self-parking vehicle and so on. But the challenges that we have is predictability. We don't really know what is happening within the next 10 seconds once I get to that intersection. That we don't really know, you know what, that map that I downloaded, is that actually still current or actually did something change since I got the last map update? Or actually, I might like to know, you know what, behind that turn, is there maybe a backup or something like that, and it would be quite helpful if I could slow down already. So the predictability and context of the overall situation is really harder to get from sensors. Now, the connectivity part that we looked at our time scale here, what does that look like? There's a lot of work, industry, academia, and also in the government. Applications are a little bit unclear. And that is really something, if you follow the discussion regarding this DSRC, dedicated short-range communication, many of them are saying, yeah, we're talking about this wireless brake light, we are talking about this blind intersection assist, we are talking about emergency vehicle needs to get through and so on. But it's really like, what are we using this for? Oops, here we go. And the challenges that remain are really for the use case and even more for the infrastructure and deployment. How do we get these systems out? Well, might fit quite nicely together. That we really say, you know what? One's strength is another one's weakness and the other way around. That we can really say, you know what? If we connect those vehicles, if we use maybe already what's available today, cellular communication, that we can actually cover quite a bit what creates us a lot of tummy aches still with automation. Now, to attempt to summarize all of this, the two main trends really that I see here, I know that I showed many more arrows and so on, but I try to summarize all of this. So we are talking a lot about this, and I find we need to talk a little bit more about this as well, which is, yeah, we are having this evolution of driver assistance in these personal vehicles, which is, basically, the system takes over, at least in part, from the human, and they go through traffic jam assist, auto parking, and so on. But I find we should also take a look at this because it might be a pretty interesting scenario, like these automated people movers, something like this, which might be, in the end, the integration of public transportation and individual mobility, something like the personalization of public transportation or the publication of the personal automobile. But really where the motivation is to have fewer staff and maybe a little bit more flexible schedules, automated trams, driverless pods, and so on that we looked at. I think there's a lot to be gained from. You can really say, you know what? It's not just one way where we go with the automated vehicle. And it might already be here, or at least it might be here sooner than we think, but different than you might expect. Thanks for your attention. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Sven. We've got a little bit of time for questions, but I'm going to have to ask you to wait until I run over to you to say the question into the microphone. So go ahead and raise your hand, and I will come over.
Someone in the very back. You have
there
to
we go.
Fall.
It's always in the very back.
Thank you. So you talked about the aspect of safety and also communication and also autonomous vehicles. So one aspect that I would like to know your take on that is about policies. So So about the governments and now you know the feds are all over autonomous vehicles. So what do you think about that?
Well, you see, what I showed, like these four diamonds in the beginning, was the motivation. So I would challenge if policy is the motivation for automated vehicles. Therefore, I talk more about what's on the receiving end, but hopefully on the giving end, policies are needed. And I do know that Bryant Walker Smith also gave a talk here in December, I believe, talking about legal aspects of automated vehicles. And I know his work very, very well, and I know that, or I actually learned from him quite a bit. So that means, policies are needed, and it really varies a lot which region we are talking about. If you talk about here in the United States, where it seems to be something like automated vehicles per se are not illegal, so you can do it. And still, I personally applaud a lot what's happening in different states, because they're putting out regulation, they're putting out a framework, what it means to operate, most of the times for testing so far, how to operate those vehicles, so that it's not being done in a vacuum. I think it's a very challenging situation, and this is what NHTSA is obviously pointing out, that individual states are doing individual things, and NHTSA, I'm not sure if they are trying to catch up, so I'm not sure if everyone knows what NHTSA is. That's Department of Transportation, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And that is certainly a challenging situation, but I personally still think that we are in a relatively good situation with this, where the technology progress and the policy progress are not that far dissynced. And so I'm pretty confident about it. But in answering your question, it's definitely needed. And the United States might be, from a policy standpoint, a somewhat more open environment. That does not mean that it's easy around here, because the challenges might be, in the end, that the reputational damage to the companies might be much, much higher than the liability that they actually have. And in other countries, it might be the opposite. Definitely needs to be considered. Sure.
I think one really interesting thing to do is look at it from the user experience point of view. We did a workshop, and we brought in a diverse bunch of people to ask, given this, what would it be like? What would life be like, or what would transportation be like? Mm-hmm. People came up with some interesting ideas. They had this idea that a person who practiced trombone might want an autonomous car because they could travel in the car and practice while the car was driving, and mm-hmm. wouldn't have to bother people. Or people doing job interviews, the intimacy of being in a car but not having to look directly at the person might make driving in an autonomous car a desirable place for doing job interviews. People also were thinking that if you had a lot of change, if you were moving from one kind of transportation mode to another, you'd want to stay together with the same bunch of people. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of interesting directions this goes in terms of changing, you might say, the lifestyle of mobility. Three things came out of it. One is the complexity of it is going to be so much higher. If you have a lot of different choices, I mean, right now, just you're trying to coordinate with your wife, who's going to pick up the kids.
Yep.
Imagine if you have six different transportation modes and you have a large number of people to coordinate, you will not be able to do it without some assisted intelligence mm-hmm. to do that. The other thing is just the data. You're going to be in such a data fog. The car generates so much data, knows so much about you, it's going to make the cell phone look pretty uninformed. It's going to have a much better sense of your mood and mm-hmm. such. So I think these interesting things are, from the user experience point of view, come out very close, in very close contact to the kinds of things that you're talking about here.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you mentioned this, or that you emphasize this piece. One other piece of research that I do is in electric mobility. And in electric mobility, for instance, you see a lot that people say, or that scholars even say, you know what, people don't drive that much. They only drive maximum 40 miles a day, and therefore everyone should be happy with this vehicle. But that is, I think, missing the point. Yes, and I'm saying this here at Nissan, but this is open for discussion. It's a meetup, after all. Because an automobile is not just a means to get from A to B. It is something that people pay much, much more than they would need to pay to get from A to B, so that they get freedom, flexibility, independence, and so on. And so if you say, well, what are the use cases? And I hadn't thought about it, but if people say, you know what, I really want to be together with these people while commuting, which is an emotional piece, it's a psychological piece, and this is also why I did mean really to put up some of these things, what we can learn from early deployments, how humans actually interact with these automated vehicles, if it's something that they enjoy. And there's, with none of these things that are showed, it's a black or white thing. And I hope that through the different levels of automation that I was making clear, well, there will also be a lot of gray tones what we will have as automated vehicles in the future. But I'm really thankful that you're pointing out that, after all, it's people with desires, with dreams, with anxieties, with preferences, using those whatever automated vehicles, and that it's not so easy to just say, you know what, you just get in this thing, press a button, done. It's not that easy. Agree.
So great talks, man. I've been echoing some of these themes in some essays I wrote recently, and so I'm really pleased to see other people say them too. But I want to get to one particular point, because mm-hmm. another thing I'm writing some new essays about is all the different types of infrastructure that are involved mm-hmm. with this. And there's the physical infrastructure we talk about a lot, but the virtual infrastructure, which is this communications thing, is mm-hmm. interesting. And in your slide about the famous IT company that's unnamed, mm-hmm. There was one very important thing that not a lot of people kid in, which is that famous IT company is the world's most advanced mapping company. Mm-hmm. And the maps are a huge part of what they built, and mm-hmm. they are the virtual infrastructure yep. upon which that vehicle drives. Mm-hmm. And at that unnamed company, things are a little bit different. If someone says, to do that, we'd have to drive every street in America, someone else says, okay.
Yep.
Right? I mean, that doesn't happen a lot of places, but that sort of thinking mm-hmm. is growing. That isn't the only company that can think
that's
that
right.
way now.
Yep.
And so I think there's more to that, and people haven't been catching that part of it. Mm-hmm. The thing that you said, and actually I like it, kind of goes with me when people say it, I don't think it's your main theme, but that, you know, because their background is in making money from web advertising, that that maybe that's what they're interested in, this technology. And so driving costs about $20 an hour, mm-hmm. and advertising makes about 60 cents an hour. So there's orders of magnitude difference mm-hmm. in the value between those things.
Yep.
So that may not be much of a question, but the virtual infrastructure thing is the thing I'd like to hear more about.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Infrastructure in general, I typically come up with three. So for whatever reason, I always do three things. Definitely the physical that you pointed out, the virtual, and also find the legal, which was asked just as the first question. I think these are the three infrastructure topics you really have to talk about when we talk about automated vehicles, because we do have an infrastructure already today of vehicle communication, which is eye contact or waving, something like this. And I just don't really see how an automated vehicle can be added to this, again, what I called earlier, a somehow functioning chaos without an additional layer of infrastructure. And this might be all three of them. And I definitely think that the communication piece is a very important one, because again, if you look at all the examples that I had as highly automated vehicles, and highly I mean now everything that goes beyond the conditional automation, basically, then you do see that they are connected. And very often, I mean, you're on these talks also a lot, we do get the question, well, we have autopilot on an airplane, can we not have an autopilot in a car and everything's so easy? Well, yeah, if you have two highly trained professionals in an automobile and a centralized traffic management coordinator and then vehicle-to-vehicle communication, you might be able to do it. So I just think you need to have this virtual infrastructure to really exchange data, whether that is a data exchange with a centralized server or data exchange directly in between vehicles. I don't say, I also really want to emphasize this, I don't say that for every step that we are taking from here going forward that we need necessarily infrastructure in the communication sense. But definitely for the ultimate scenario, this picture from the year 2000, I find we probably need a higher degree of infrastructure. And the good news is that as we are moving along and having our, probably largely will be an evolutionary approach, I assume that we will build more and more of this infrastructure as well. So I'm confident. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One quick counter, 15% of all car accidents, most people don't know this, are with deer.
Mm-hmm. 15% of all car accidents are with deer. And we're not going to find a way to get all the deer to wear transponders.
Mm-hmm.
Sharks
true.
With freaking laser beams.
That's right.
true. So the 15%, I trust you because you research your data typically very well. But then there's a question maybe for anyone in the auditorium here.
I think it's 16%.
60%.
It's 2 million deer strikes.
Well, but here's the question. Why don't we have on these automated vehicles infrared sensing on there? Because I was giving a tour to a bunch of students from Japan this morning. It was one of these tours where I show them our lab, and it's fine, do it all the time. All of a sudden, they look
they
at Juno.
They didn't come here, Sven? What is this?
Well, I can put you in touch. I can put you in touch and show up here tomorrow morning, guaranteed. They're great people. Because they gave me this question, like, well, on Junior, those of you who don't know Junior, it's the vehicle from the DARPA Urban Challenge, the VW Passat with laser scanner, radar, and camera, and so on. Why does it not have infrared? And I said, no one ever asked me this. I mean, it doesn't mean that the researchers were never asked, because I did not build the car, so I'm not smart enough to build the car. Might be smart enough to change the suspension and everything, but I couldn't do the sensing. So why don't we have infrared sensing for this? Because you would detect a deer. So why are we not doing this?
Very expensive, low resolution right now.
That's an automotive industry answer, Brad. You can do better than that.
I played a bunch with a camera.
But, I mean, to the point in the end, yes, you can do this and this and add all of it. Tells me again that where we are at with all of this, right? And you do see the videos from Sebastian where they actually have a deer near Lake Tahoe or whatever it was, and or moose, whatever it was. And so maybe we have not figured out yet what sensors we're actually needing, because we do say, yes, the laser scanner needs to get smaller and everything. And we do see very small laser scanners in the Nissan vehicles. But maybe we need to add a temperature sensing, so an infrared sensor as well.
So I want to continue in this kind of vein of discussion. So both the maps, I mean, you know, I actually think we need a talk on maps and what type of maps do we really need for autonomous vehicles. You know, my feeling is that if you need a company to build an autonomous vehicle that needs to drive every road in the world in order to have a vehicle there later on, we're going to wait a long time. So we need to change this. Mm-hmm. You know, So that's just the thing, right? Mm-hmm. So, but what type of information do we need in the map, and how consistent? And so that's one thing. The other thing I think in your evolution, revolution, transformation, maybe the time is this testing issue.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I think, you know, yes, the unnamed IT company next door, you know, might have driven a lot of miles, but it's really difficult to go the next step. It's really difficult to test scenarios that you don't want to test in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I do want to test a scenario where the old lady is crossing the road and my car doesn't see the, and what happens. And
that's
I can't do this on the road, so I need to find a way to test this.
Well, you're Mythbusters, or I mean, go ahead.
So I think, you know, part of the companies, and this might be for startup companies, is that we need testing environments for autonomous systems. Testing environments in the lab, testing environments in virtual reality. You know, we have a virtual reality simulator here where we test our autonomous vehicle in. The hardest thing is to test the sensors into the virtual reality. What do you do? Are you going to make a simulation of a LiDAR, you know, in the, you know, and so what if you make a virtual world from this area here? Is the car going to be able to see through the trees in the simulator? You know, that is the hard part, I think, that people don't realize about going from a car that can drive itself to a car that drives itself in situations that you're going to encounter in the world. And I don't think anybody has a real good answer to this question yet. And we need, you know, this is where working together, where you say these symbiotic relationships are necessary.
And that's exactly a discussion I had, again, earlier this week, because some of you know, looks like we will be getting one of these automated urban mobility systems to our lab. One of the things that I showed earlier, the one here on the right. And we will deploy it somewhere on Stanford campus. And so then we're getting together like, okay, they're giving us this vehicle, and we trust them, sure, but how do we make sure? And now we're actually coming up with our own specifications, how we test it, at least first for us, in a somewhat limited environment and everything. And that is, again, something where you hopefully can learn from it, how you do it for something that only runs maximum 12 miles an hour, and only maybe on like 2 acres maximum in the beginning. But where you can definitely learn, like, what did you experience when you threw just a blanket in front of this thing? Did it do anything? Or what we were asked with this vehicle here on the right, which is hard to see on this resolution, but you know which one I mean, this people mover. Well, what if someone actually lies on the ground? Do actually the laser scanners pick it up or not? And so this is really something where I said it a few times, but I will say it again, but we can learn a lot from other automated vehicles by not just looking at what's going with 65 miles on the freeway. And also on the IT company, we always say, well, the company that we're not mentioning. Actually, I talked to some other IT companies, and they said, well, should we get involved in this field? So it's not just one company. Certainly one is way ahead. But there seems to be a trend that not just one IT company, others as well, are definitely watching very, very closely what's happening with automated vehicles. Therefore, I thought it might be of interest to really try to summarize the conversation a little bit.
Okay, so I had a couple of people with questions, but unfortunately our time is up. So if you want to race everybody, my two friends right here, if you want to race everybody up, Sven has about 5 minutes before he goes, but he has somewhere else that he needs to get, and he wanted to fraternize with everyone, but I need to cut everybody off about right now. So we have about 5 minutes to discuss, but first I have we got you your very own 370Z, two-door sports coupe right here. as a token of our appreciation.
Wow.
And this is a Nissan jacket for the next time you go to Detroit.
Ooh, yeah, sure. Great.
Round of applause for Sven.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks very much, everyone.